Okay, let's start. Good morning. I'm Jeff Mechanic. I am an assistant director at the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And I'd like to welcome all of you, including those of you in the audience, to the first of our two public roundtables here in Los Angeles today on the LISAS project. We've already held roundtables jointly with the International Accounting Standards Board, or IASB, in Sao Paulo, London, Norwalk, Connecticut, and tomorrow there will be a roundtable or two out in Singapore. Roundtables are an important part of our public due process. They help us to better understand and to further explore in an interactive way the feedback we receive in our comment in the comment letters. As all of you know, the LISAS project that we've been doing jointly with the IASB is a very important and wide-ranging project aimed at improving the accounting for leases by both lessees and lessors. We will be discussing the revised proposal issued earlier in 2013 by the two boards. And having read the views expressed in the comment letters from each of the participants around the table, I think we're in for a pretty lively discussion. So let's start by going around the room and briefly introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the organization or group of organizations that you're representing. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, everyone. I'm an assistant director at the FASB.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Sachs. I'm a managing director with Duff & Phelps. We are an investment banking firm and a valuation services firm focused on financial reporting and other matters.
I would just ask each of you just to speak as closely into the mic as you can. Thank you.
Larry Smith, a member of the FASB.
Hi, good morning. I'm Heidi Roth. I'm the Senior Vice President, Chief Accounting Officer, and Controller at Kilroy Realty Corporation. We are a West Coast-based office REIT here, headquartered here in Los Angeles.
I'm Rick Peterson. I'm with Financial Reporting Advisors. We're a small public accounting firm that specializes in financial reporting.
Tom Linsmeyer, FASB.
I'm George Loris. I'm the Director of Accounting Policy and Emerging Standards at Toyota Financial Services. We are the finance arm of Toyota Motor Corp in the U.S.
Ed Conjoyan, Senior Vice President with Majestic Realty. Majestic is the largest privately held developer and owner of commercial real estate in the country. We're headquartered here in Los Angeles, have offices in Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, Las Vegas, and outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jim Croker with the FASB.
It's Elias Habayeb. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for International Lease Finance Corporation. We're one of the largest aircraft lessors. We manage and own about 1,000 aircraft that we lease about 200 airlines around the world. We're also a SEC registrant. We have over $20 billion of debt in the capital markets.
Good morning. My name is Kimber Bascom, and I'm a partner with KPMG.
Daryl Buck, FASB.
Pat Bailey, Director of Finance and Principal. I'm representing the MBA. I'm the Vice Chair of their Management Committee.
Hi, I'm Marianne Aguiar from URS Corporation, headquartered in San Francisco. I am the Director of Financial Controls and Technical Accounting Services. And we responded along with other large engineering construction companies in a joint response in terms of a comment letter.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Muehlbauer. I'm with the FASB staff.
Good morning. Danielle Zayer, FASB staff.
Thank you all. This roundtable, as well as this afternoon's roundtable, will be recorded, and the recordings of the roundtables will be posted to the FASB website within the next couple of days. So it's very important, again, to speak into the mic. I would also ask you to identify yourselves when speaking if I fail to do so in calling upon you. Finally, to keep order to our discussion, I would ask each of you when you wish to speak to stand your placard on end as best as you can, and that'll help Danielle and I track who to call in what order. However, if you do have a point to make that's directly on point with respect to the point that's being made by someone else, I would ask you to just, you can raise both hands like this, both fingers like that, and signal, okay? Thank you. So we're going to start by talking about the lessee accounting proposals, and Danielle is going to tee that up.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hopefully everyone has a copy of our agenda. We have it divided into four separate topics. So to the extent we can stay on topic, I know sometimes when we're talking about the model, it's easy to get into the measurement issues, but let's try to hold that off till we're talking about measurement and just kind of try to get through all these topics. And we'll start, we'll spend maybe the next 30 minutes on the lessee accounting model. And everyone is aware of our proposals for the lessee to recognize a right of use asset and an obligation to make lease payments, and that there would be a distinction in the income statement depending on whether you are a type A lease or a type B lease, and that would distinguish whether you have interest and amortization or a straight line rent expense in your income statement. And so if we turn on the agenda to page 3, we have some questions. I guess for the lessee accounting, we can start with questions 1, 2, and 4, talking about the dual approach that the boards have proposed and if there are different economics for different leases that would lead to two different models, and if you agree with the classification criteria that we've come up with that would have most real estate property leases to be reported differently from most other leases in the lessee's income statement and cash flow statement. And we're also looking for some suggestions or changes that the board can make to the proposals to help simplify the lessee model. So with that, I'll turn it over to the participants. Is there someone that wants to start first on the lessee proposed accounting model?
Okay, go ahead, Rick. Rick Peterson.
Well, I'll start out with is saying that while we agree that it makes sense to put leases on the balance sheet, we think that the model that the FASB has proposed is more complicated than it needs to be, and specifically the type A and the type B models. Leases are very flexible instruments. You can do a lot of things with a lease. But at the end of the day, a lessee has a right to use an asset. And in our view, whether the lessee has a right to use that asset for 2 years or 10 years, they get the same use out of that asset every year. And we just do not see the concept behind having a type A and a type B lease. We think that it will increase dramatically the complexity of trying to do the accounting on the lessee side. It's going to be complex enough because lessees that have thousands of leases for the first time will need to develop the systems to actually recognize the assets and liabilities and to put two types of leases in there and all of the different things that go into it, we think is just not a good idea from a complexity standpoint. And we also, frankly, don't believe it's the right conceptual answer to have two types of leases for lessees.
Kimber?
Thank you. We're also supportive of the efforts that the boards have undertaken to improve the accounting for leases versus current GAAP. We think there's some clear issues with current GAAP. What I think the question on the multiple accounting models for lessees and the reactions to that has raised is whether the right thing to account for in a lease is the underlying asset or is the economic rights that each of the parties ends up with related to the underlying asset. So early on in the project, in response to the desire of financial statement users, the boards decided to pursue a right of asset approach for lease accounting. And that came with some consequences. And subsequently, as those consequences started to play out in the financial reporting results that you would get if you followed that construct, there were reactions that I think were understandable about different leases being different. So you got feedback from financial statement users, for example, that said, we don't think all leases are alike. Well, if you're going to differentiate between leases and your thing that you're accounting for as a right of use, then the it seems to us that the characteristics of the underlying asset aren't necessarily relevant to the right of use. Things that are relevant to the right of use might be optional features in the agreement itself. So purchase options or renewal options might differentiate one right of use from another. Payment mechanisms, like whether you have payments that are contingent on sales or payments that are contingent on the future value of an asset, might differentiate one right of use from another. But it seems to us that the characteristics of the underlying asset and the type of underlying asset and the extent to which the lessee consumes the underlying asset don't per se differentiate a right of use from another right of use, because a right of use is just a bundle of economic rights. Equally, it seems that if you believe that a lease creates shared use of an underlying asset and that therefore one of the parties to that agreement should account for their portion of those economic rights that are separated relative to that underlying asset, it's hard to see why both parties shouldn't do that. But yet it's clear that financial statement users broadly seem to like where lessor accounting is. So it seems to us that's left the boards in a pretty tough spot. Some of the compromises that have come as a result of that are trying to be responsive to those differing perspectives, but we think that they are very damaging in the context of the accounting that we do for other assets and other financial liabilities. So we have very significant concerns about moving forward with the proposals as they stand.
Larry Smith.
So I think that was a pretty good summary of where we are and how we got to where we are. I think at the end of the day, both boards have effectively compromised somewhat in order to respond to the various different views as to exactly what a lease contract is. And what I hear you saying, Kimber, is, okay, boards, you took a good crack at it, but you overly complicated the model, and therefore, why don't you go back and try to reach more of a conceptual reason for doing, or a conceptual response, and, you know, make our decision as to what we feel are the economics, and let's stick to it. So pick a model, and I think I hear you saying that you like the notion of accounting for the rights under the contract as opposed to looking to the underlying asset. And if you're going to do that, then pick the model and account for those rights and the obligations. If you're not going to do that, then perhaps retain something similar that would be more based on accounting for the underlying asset, if I recall your comment letter.
Yeah, maybe if I could just clarify that a little bit. We clearly support the effort to improve current lease accounting. As far as whether that is based on a right of use as the right thing to account for or based on the underlying asset as the right thing to account for, I don't think we've been able to resolve in our own minds which is the better starting point. But what we do think is whichever direction you go, you should try to be consistent with the concepts that you have for other assets and liabilities. And the one advantage of, I'll just say, the underlying asset type of approach is that it's more consistent with where you are now. It's more consistent probably with what you might see, for example, from a contractual law, tax, and bankruptcy type of perspective. So there are some advantages to that in that respect. The issue gets back to when you decide that something goes on the balance sheet and that it's there because it's a financing transaction, should it be reflected that way then in the rest of the financial statements? If it's on the balance sheet because it's a financing, it seems like it ought to be reported as a financing in all of the basic financial statements.
Okay. So can I follow up? Sorry.
Sure.
I just want to make sure I understand. So if we go down the underlying asset route, which I think you have correctly pointed out, there's some good precedents in terms of bankruptcy law, et cetera. That sounds very much like current GAAP in certain respects. And therefore, from a lessee perspective, can I, and let's say we go down that route and we either retain FAS 13 or go to IAS 17 in terms of the dividing line. Do I hear you then say that from a lessee's perspective that you don't put the obligation on your balance sheet?
Yeah, our perspective is if you are accounting for the underlying asset and looking at who controls the underlying asset, then if the lessee doesn't control the underlying asset, they wouldn't report an asset and a liability, and they'd report the transaction as an executory arrangement.
Okay.
Okay. Tom Linsmeyer.
Jeff, can I ask if we can get some more volume on this? I can't hardly hear some people, and I'm sure the people in the audience might be having more trouble than me.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, they'll try. Thank you. Tom, go ahead.
I think it's appropriate that we'd be challenged about whether we resolve what the asset is, because I don't know that we've collectively come to a conclusion what the asset is. But I find in some respects, the argument you just made, Kimber, I'm not understanding very well, because it seems, at least it says, that the right of use is different from the underlying, because you're saying the lessor owns the underlying. So it's a separate benefit that participates in the asset but doesn't own the asset. I don't understand, but then is that a unique thing, a unique type of asset, or is it the same as, if it's not the underlying physical asset, is it an intangible asset? I've never heard of an intangible that lets you use a tangible. I have a very hard time viewing it as a service if you talk about it as an executory contract, because most services are consumed as you get them, not give you the right to a physical for an extended period of time. So I have challenges in thinking about this issue, in being challenged to say, figure out what the asset is, but then account for it like other assets in the balance sheet. And I think that what we've done is create a model for a unique asset. It's not an intangible, it's not a service, it's not a physical asset. But yet I don't think we've talked about it and justified that extensively. And I think what we've chosen to decide is, at least a key aspect of lease contracts are that some lease contracts, when you pay for them, is not just access to the asset over time, but some of the lease contracts, the payment is for the diminution in value of the asset. So the payment is to diminution of the value of the asset and right to use. Other assets are just access to the asset because the asset doesn't really decline much in value over time. I'm curious as to whether you don't think that's economically significant, you two, right? Or that's not really a viable way of thinking about the asset and the balance sheet. But I like
this is Rick Peterson. It's a contract. To me, it's a valuable contractual right. I don't have a problem slotting it into an intangible asset think in my mind when I'm looking at this from a lessee perspective. Secondly, I would say, other than land, I think all assets decline in value, get consumed during the term of a lease. It may be a little, it may be a lot, but other than land, which they don't make much of it anymore, well, off the coast of Pakistan they did.
Yeah, they did.
But they just don't make much of it anymore. But other than that, I think it all, there's some amount of consumption in every lease if you look at it from that perspective. And so I don't see that distinguishing in my mind one lease from another.
Can I just add to that? Sorry, since Tom asked. I think my perspective on a right of use is that every right of use gets consumed. There's not any one of them that I know of that would indefinitely exist. And I am confused as to why the level of consumption of the underlying asset is relevant when I think about
the right of use itself, because the right of use itself will expire. It is finite. Even if it relates to land, it is finite. As far as whether it's tangible or intangible, I guess I generally thought that there was really only two kinds of assets. One was tangible and the other one was intangible. I mean, I guess you could make up a new category, but I don't personally think that would really be all that beneficial to financial statement users. And, you know, on balance, this asset, I think, has a lot of the characteristics of the physical asset in the sense that it's the physical asset that you're using. If you wanted to call that a fixed asset, it wouldn't bother me, but I understand the perspective that it's related to a contract and you could view it as an intangible as well. In either case, though, I think we have guidance about the accounting for those, whether it's tangible or intangible, that I think is important. And I think it's equally important to think about the accounting for financial liabilities, because I think what goes on the balance sheet is a payment stream on the liability side, and that's got to be a financial liability.
Yeah, I remain unconvinced that there's only two types of assets. You got financial assets. I don't know what prepaid expenses are, but deferred costs. There's a bunch of assets there. So I have a challenge being challenged to say you have to apply intangible accounting or tangible asset accounting to leases, because I don't think that they're very much the same. And I think a very unique part of a lease is that it is one unit of account in which you have the financing and the right to use the asset together. In many tangible or intangible assets, if there's any financing, it is separate. And I think that makes it a far different animal to be thinking about. Not that I'm convinced exactly how we should be doing it, but I do have a problem thinking about being challenged to say treat it like a tangible or intangible.
Okay, I have Darryl Buck and then Mary Ann.
Just want to ask one more follow-up of Rick and understand a little bit more about what you were in favor of and maybe juxtapose that against where I think some of the issues that Kimber may have are. First of all, I think I understood you to say that you would be fine with lessees recording the liability for these rights of use. And then I think where you said that the complications come in is trying to then differentiate and account for two different types of leases by lessees. And if you accept that, I believe you indicated that the right of use is the same throughout the term of the lease. That makes me think then that you would be in favor of some model that would reflect that same usage throughout the term as going through the statement of activity. Now, to get there, the question becomes, okay, do you prefer type A or type B? If type A, you know, you're not going to get that equal expense. It's going to be more front-loaded. So if you go type B, to get it, then I think Kimber's probably going to say, well, that's problematic with the way that you amortize that asset from a conceptual standpoint. So how do you suppose that we should get over that hurdle?
Well, I mean, part of this is leases are an incredibly flexible animal. I mean, if you wanted, and I occasionally, not often see, I sometimes see a lease that's completely prepaid. That's not the norm by any stretch. But there are some fact patterns where it makes sense to do so. So, I mean, they're very flexible. You can do anything you want to with them. So when I say right of use and I say equal benefit in every period, I'm talking about the asset. I'm not talking about financing the right of use. I'm talking about the asset, in my mind, an intangible asset, but the contractual right. So when I say I think there should be an equal expense recognized each period, I'm talking about the amortization of the right to use asset. The problem that we have here, that has been identified and absolutely true, that under the type A, which is the type that I prefer, the total cost related to the asset absolutely declines over time. I would say we have that exact same problem with every long-lived asset that a company acquires. There aren't many companies that are completely equity financed. I mean, you buy a big capital asset, you borrow a bunch of money, some percentage of it, that phenomena occurs on every long-lived asset that in our accounting model today. So if people think that's not the right way to account for the amortization or depreciation of long-lived assets, okay, I'm open to kind of rethinking. You can get your buddy Steve Zeff. He'd enlighten us all about how an increasing rate method of depreciation should be used for all assets.
Right.
Not you know, and so, you know, if these lease assets were treated like all other assets, okay. But I struggle with having a separate model of amortization methodology just for these lease assets, and especially where the pattern is so dependent upon the degree to which I decide to finance through the lease.
So your preference for A then indicates, I think what you're saying is that you would think that all leases are financings.
All leases have some element of financing. But leases are such a flexible animal. I mean, there are some leases that you can look at and you can say that's all the lease is about is financing. Other leases you can look at and you could say, well, I'm leasing a shop in the middle of this huge mall. I couldn't buy this thing. It doesn't matter how much cash I have in my pocket. I couldn't buy that thing. So yes, leases are very flexible, and I can't say they all are done for one reason or all are done for the other. But because you have this obligation to make payments, you sign this contract, I would say our accounting model would say that that should be reflected as a financing obligation.
Okay. Mary Ann Aguirre?
Yes, I just wanted to add to that. So, you know, we support generally, you know, the right-of-use model, and we support the dual approach that is currently in the proposal. We do believe that there are economic differences with the leases. We believe that some are more akin to a sales transaction that we're actually financing versus some are more in nature an executory contract where we actually consume the benefits over time. I think space in a building, we evenly consume those benefits over time. I think you pointed out a little bit earlier where, you know, type A counts in the fact that, you know, it's a right of use payment as well as you're giving a portion of your payment is for the depreciation or the deterioration or the actual use of that value, whereas type B is just really more the payment for using that space. And we do believe that that is more in line with actually consuming the benefits over time, and that's why we support that recognition of the expense in the P&L on a straight line basis. You're probably going to hear from me on this topic many times, but I have to point out a very selfish impact that the engineering construction industry has, as long as with all other U.S. government contractors. But the characterization of type A expense, and I know we're not quite at that point in terms of measurement and then subsequent accounting, would have a very real impact. And to move to a full model where there's only one type and assume the default is a type A, you're looking at a very real impact to anyone that works under cost reimbursable projects. And it's just not a timing issue. It's a real impact to our bottom line, our revenues, our earnings, because it would reduce, based upon current FAR and CAS regulations, it would reduce our reimbursement. So given that, as well as we believe the economics of leasing transactions are different, we support the dual approach.
Go ahead, Jim Croker.
I just had a question on the impact in terms of cost reimbursement under Type A, whether that's dependent on how it would be characterized under Type A. So if, for example, you had the Type A method of recognition in the income statement, but it was the combined expense was still called rent expense, would that matter? I just wanted to understand, is it how we would characterize it? So if we called it interest expense plus right of use amortization, or if it was combined, or is the regs really tied to if there is accounting that imputes a finance charge?
So the regs really talk about interest expense is non-reimbursable, and we actually have in our letter a suggestion or a proposal that if you do keep the type A, that you allow for the characterization of those two components to be characterized as rent expense with disclosure in the financial statements of the different components. There's the fear, though, that within the proposal, you still refer to interest. And so we don't know it would be a clear shot that just because we have that characterization on the P&L that we would not see, you know, any questions on that number.
Even for a type B, there still is that imputed interest component. It's just the characterization. Obviously, our preference would be to at least have that characterization on the income statement as rent.
Thank you.
Okay. Ed Conjoyan and then Tom Linsmar.
Sure. So being from the real estate industry, we would, of course, suggest that the real estate is different. Now, I profess I don't know anything about aircraft leasing, but I do know a thing or two about real estate. And as was acknowledged, land isn't depreciated. So there are characteristics to real estate that do make it different. I think even under the type A, type B models, that even under type B, the straight line doesn't necessarily reflect the actual number that we have. It's still a construct, and the actual number being actual rent that's paid by a tenant and received by a landlord. But nevertheless, to me, the more fundamental issue is I think what was mentioned earlier in terms of leases are flexible. Some leases sure are financings, and some sure are not. And the trouble that we have is that it appears that this exposure draft is an attempt to put all leases into the bucket that all leases are financing. If you agree with the premise that they are flexible and some are clearly financing, some are not, that takes us back to where we are today with capital leases and operating leases. And what we would, the IT guy doesn't like what I'm saying, maybe. You got the kill switch down there, is that what it is? Take out the real estate guy? Anyway, what we would suggest is that the current mousetrap seems to work just fine. We're also a big user of financial statements. As you can imagine, with 70 million square feet across the country, we're evaluating the creditworthiness of tenants all the time. We're looking at financial statements. And we personally are satisfied with the current disclosure. We think that it could be improved through additional footnote disclosure. But to characterize all leases as financing, we feel is just not accurate. Out here in California, we tend to have earthquakes every now and then. And when an earthquake knocks down a building, the tenant gets to walk away from that building. And we've experienced that before. It's not a fun situation, but the fact of the matter is the tenant gets to do that. If that were a financing, and if the tenant had actually purchased that building and had taken out debt, the tenant could not walk away from the financing. A lease is an executory contract. They are not all financings and should not be put on the balance sheet as far as we're concerned. Thank you.
Darrell Buck.
Just a follow-up for Ed. Ed, do you believe that the fact that the proposal would require all leases to be on the balance sheet means that we consider them all to be financings, including type B?
I believe you consider them to all be assets and liabilities, which we don't believe they are.
Tom Linsmar, I don't know if you still want to speak.
Marianne, I just wanted to follow up. Has the industry had any conversations with the government about whether they are going to be, I know that the government is aware of what's happening, but has there been any conversations with that to see if there would be adjustments to the reimbursement process? I know that's more challenging because there's not an active place to be dealing with that, but I was just curious.
I'm sure it'd be a big challenge. I'm sure each of the companies have had conversations with their local individuals that they have spoken to, and I think we're trying to raise the awareness. But I think as a whole, everyone believes it's a major hurdle to expect them to change the regulations. And the other point we want to point out, too, and we point out in the letter, is just not U.S. government contractors, but a lot of states, for ease of use, adopt the standards as set by the government. So it's much more far-reaching than just working on U.S. government jobs. It's also state and other agencies as well.
Thank you.
Okay, Elias?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is just kind of add a little bit more color and echo some of the comments about leasing in general, at least as it comes to aircraft leasing. I agree leases are flexible, but from our perspective, they generally fall in two different buckets, thinking from a commercial perspective. There are those leases that are really financings, that are entered into with an airline or someone who wants to buy a plane, and we're extending a loan to finance the sale through the form of a lease. We price that like a loan, and we manage it from a credit risk perspective. But the bulk of our business in aircraft leasing are operating leases. I got a 25 to 35-year asset. Over its life, it's going to be flown 3 to 5, maybe more airlines. You know, it is my plane. I'm on risk for the plane throughout its lifetime, and I'll give it to one airline to fly for some time, and then when they're done, I move it to another airline. At all times, I keep the residual value risk. The other thing that's important to understand is airlines don't only lease aircraft for financial reasons. Many airlines can borrow cheaper than we can borrow, but the reason they do it is part of their fleet planning to maintain flexibility within their fleet, to keep their fleet young. And many airlines don't want to take on the residual value risk. You've got like the big ones in Europe, the Air France, KLM. They'll own 2/3 of their fleet, but the remaining third they want to keep at least. They don't want to take on the residual value risk. And from our perspective, the way that lease gets priced is very different than if it's financing a sale of an aircraft. It's driven by supply and demand, what lift is available at that point in time and what kind of lift the airline needs. And that's going to dictate the price we're going to get for it. And from our perspective, we're managing the asset. We look at where we can lease it, and we look at other options if leasing isn't attractive. You know, we have the capabilities to part out the plane and recycle the parts. Sometimes the parts are worth more of the whole. So there's a substantive commercial difference between one lease and the other. And as we talk to the users of our financial statements, whether they are the rating agency, whether it's our investors, other analysts that cover us, providing that difference, reflecting that difference in our financials is critical to them. And providing that clarity is key to them, to be able to know how to judge our performance and evaluate us.
Larry Smith.
This might sound like a stupid question, but in your operating leases, if the federal government were to ban the use of a particular type of aircraft for various reasons, and do so for a long period of time or permanently, what are the obligations of the operating lessee with respect to those lease payments?
The plane comes back, they have no more, the operating lessee has no more obligations.
So it's similar to the building and the earthquake.
Yeah, and we just find some other jurisdiction and another airline around the world to fly it. It's basically like that. We lease planes in 80 different countries. To 200 airlines around the world.
What about a? Now you said that there are times when you your lease transactions are effectively financings, where the.
So we have
provisions different for, let's say, a quote unquote capital lease.
Yeah.
With respect to that risk.
The way we price the deal and structure the deal and the way we account for it is very different. So if it's structured as a sale, whereby there's installment payments, and then at the end they'll get title to the plane. We book that as a loan on our balance sheet. We account for it as a loan. The plane is not sitting on our balance sheet.
Okay.
And the economics are very different. The way we price it is going to be very different than how we would do our typical operating lease.
The lease, is the lease term in that airline situation that Larry just asked you. The lease contract says that the lessee has the right to give you back the plane and not have to pay for it.
You know, I can't speak if that's the case in every case, but if the plane is not allowed to fly, there are provisions that we would have to take the plane back. And I can confirm it and come back.
So in isolated circumstances, it's possible perhaps to return the plane, but it's not a general concept within the contract.
So I can't tell you what's in every one of our contracts, since we have about 1,000 of them, but it is in many of our contracts. There are conditions on which they could return a plane.
Okay. George Loros.
Yeah, we started getting into the lessor a little bit, but I just wanted to kind of chime in on the kind of the business model approach. You know, leasing aircraft and leasing autos, they would seem to be kind of the same business, but in our industry, we have a dealer that's kind of negotiating with the customer directly, and we're simply buying the paper. But the way we look at it is the customer has the option to either finance that or lease that vehicle. So when we look at it together, we're financing the asset. But I think the difference is the length of the use of the vehicle versus an aircraft versus a car almost would drive you to a different business model where we lease the vehicle, it comes back. We don't release it. We would sell that vehicle, and hopefully we would get the financing on that. But on an aircraft, it sounds like that's something that's going to be released, and particularly with the real estate industry. That property is going to be released to a new tenant. So, you know, this concept of the business model versus the asset, I think, is also relevant to trying to figure out what type of model is appropriate from a lessee perspective.
Do you think from a lessor standpoint, current GAAP appropriately reflects those differences in business model?
I do. And like I said, I don't want to get ahead of us for the lessor side, but, you know, if the objective is to put an asset on your balance sheet, we have that. Currently, our leases are operating leases because of the length of the useful life of the vehicle. But years before, we used to have direct financing leases. So we believe it does accommodate that. And even in the standard, when you're looking to say, well, if I'm selling an asset and I have this upfront profit recognition, current GAAP provides for that, the sales type leases. So I know we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but you know, from my perspective, looking at the business model is very important in determining if the accounting model is appropriate.
Jeremy Sachs.
From a valuation perspective, you know, we're always very concerned about cash flow and the disclosure of information, you know, as a particular user to that financial information. We care about a clear delineation between a financing cost and a consumption cost. So whichever model we end up using, it's important for that to be factored in, along with the different aspects of the leases that are not necessarily captured in the model calculations. The variable payments under those leases are particularly important, and we can talk a little bit later about how that affects the measurement decision, but from a valuation perspective, the cash flow both of the variable payments and even the leases under 12-month periods would be important for our consideration.
Okay. We'll have time for that a little later. Are there any other, before we segue onto lessor accounting, are there any other comments on lessee accounting? Go ahead, Tom.
I just wanted to give insight why I think generally we don't believe leases are executory contracts. Legally, an executory contract is a contract in which neither party has performed at all. And the lessor, in some... That's what's been explained to me very carefully. Well, in any case, the lessor has performed here, and the lessee has not, in some respects in full. Now, people might disagree that that's a proper characterization, but the lessor, by transferring the physical asset to the lessee, has done something significant in comparison to the payment over time.
Jim Croker.
Follow up on that. I'm still less, it's still more of a conundrum to me as to whether these are or aren't executory contracts. So I wouldn't characterize, at least me personally, as have concluded that they're not. I think we've heard some good points as to why they might be executory contracts, at least some of them, including issues about no longer having access because of what we heard a couple weeks ago, Hurricane Sandy, earthquakes, or other things. So I think I just struggle with, if we're trying to redefine law, I think, you know, we could get legal opinions as to whether they're executory or not, or whether we're trying to figure out how to account for the rights conveyed.
I'm just
in
raising
a contract.
The fact that I think executory results are on execution, it doesn't necessarily mean that at some point, if something happens, the contract goes away necessarily.
So, Larry Smith.
So just for the sake of clarity, each of the board members at this table are speaking on behalf of themselves. That being said,
did you say that just after Tom spoke for a reason?
Tom hates me from what happened yesterday, so he'll hate me even more. No, but what Tom was explaining was the rationale for the decisions made in connection with the exposure draft. Okay, that doesn't mean that we aren't learning a lot as we go along, and I think a number of people through their comment letters and through the roundtables have made us aware of certain facts that need to be considered and perhaps were maybe considered previously but effectively dismissed for various reasons that we might want to reconsider as we redeliberate. So that I wasn't saying that Tom was just speaking on, he was really given the views that formed the basis for the exposure draft.
Exactly, because if you read the exposure draft, I was not a lover of it.
Kimber, you have a pointer.
I did notice your dissent was the longest of all of this, the dissents in the ED. Just an observation about performance that I think we've thought is that it very much depends on what the item that you're accounting for is. And this is where we struggle with the reactions to the right of use as being the item, because if you say that the right of use is the item to account for and the lessor has performed at commencement of the lease, then it's sort of difficult to then say, well, but the lessor really hasn't performed. So we should report some leases for lessors as though they haven't performed yet, which are the type B leases. So just an observation, I think if you look at the underlying asset as the item to account for, it's different. You get to the view that perhaps the lessor has not performed because the lessee doesn't have control of that item in its totality in some cases.
And you have the same relationship in terms of how you view control of the asset, because to the extent that you're looking at a right of use, you generally would effectively acknowledge, I think, that control has passed to the person in possession of it. Whereas when you're looking at the underlying asset, you kind of scratch your head and say, well, I really don't think control is passed because when it goes back to the lessor, they have the ability to sell it, et cetera, whereas the lessee doesn't have the ability to do a lot of those things to the underlying asset. So I think they go hand in hand.
Okay. I think we're probably right. Oh, go ahead, Ed.
Just one last comment. I don't know that it's been mentioned, though. Maybe it's been mentioned in a number of letters, that how bankruptcy law treats leases. And, of course, we all know in bankruptcy law, the lessee can reject the lease. And so bankruptcy law clearly treats leases as executory contracts. And just wanted to make that point to the extent.
Okay. I think we're ready to move on to lessor accounting. Could Danielle tee that up?
Okay, great. We're still on page 3 of the agenda. And at the top, we talk about the lessor accounting model. And, again, we have the breakdown between type A and type B. And so for most leases of assets other than property, that would be a type A lease, and a lessor would derecognize the underlying asset, recognize a receivable and a residual, and then recognize interest income on both the receivable and the residual, and also recognize any profit at the lease commencement date. And then for type B leases, for most leases other than or of property, a lessor would basically account for those as current operating lease accounting works today. So we have the same questions, really, on the lessor approach, just to talk about the dual approach for lessor accounting, any complexities that might introduce, and any suggestions that the boards can do to make the proposals less complex.
Who wants to start off on lessor accounting? Thank you, Elias.
So, you know, similar to what I said a little earlier, we do agree that not all leases are the same, that they're economically and commercially could be different, especially from the lessor perspective, and that the accounting model, there needs to be a dual model to recognize the different types of leases. And that's a view, it's not just an Isle of Sea view. You see it through the comment letters that came in from S&P, also from some of the equity analyst write-ups and what we've heard from our own investors. However, we don't agree with the current breakdown or the current categorization in the proposal between type A and type B. Based on the discussions we've had with the users of our financial statements, on the lessor side, the current accounting model works. It gives them the relevant financial information they need, and it also recognizes the differences between the two different types of leases. The proposal, in our case, on the aircraft leasing, most of our leases will be type A leases. The accounting model proposed for the type A leases does not work from our perspective, and nor does it work for the user community. The information it will result will reduce transparency into our financial statements. It will reduce the usefulness of our income statement, and what they're going to have to do is start looking at the statement of cash flows, and I'm going to have to come up with non-GAAP measures that gives them the information they used to get to be able to properly evaluate them. Some of the issues is that they want profit recognition. We're not selling an aircraft, or we're not selling a piece of the aircraft. My unit of account is the aircraft as a whole. This number is a number I'm going to have to make up, because when you come to our industry, we as an industry can't agree what the fair value of the aircraft is and can't agree on what methodology to use for an aircraft. And I'm happy to show you what the appraisers, you know, we have a number of appraisers in our industry. Their views on what the value of the aircraft could be up by 100%. So the fair value that we will be using is something I'm going to have to come up with. There's no... The users of our financials aren't going to believe it. The second thing is the accelerated revenue earnings recognition by treating it as interest income. That's not something the users want. They want to know, how much am I collecting? You know, and in their mind, the lease, you know, you earn revenue as the plane is used. And so they want the information they get today. They like the revenue, the rent revenue they get, the straight line recognition, because they could see they use it as a proxy for cash collection and how the aircraft is getting consumed. They like the separation between rent and depreciation. That's something. And the other part is when we deal with 25-year assets, where there's little observable data points, my accounting is going to be... there's going to involve a lot of subjectivity in the accounting, because the residual value is, to a large extent, going to be based on what my internal forecast is going to be on all the follow-on leases and what at the end of life of the plane I'm going to get for the residual. So that cannot be fixed with enough disclosures to put in. And when you deal with a portfolio of over 900 planes, you know, and what I think and what my peers might think, there's going to be wide differences between them, and it's going to reduce comparability between the different operating lessors.
On that last point, in terms of the residual values, I mean, why is it more difficult to estimate your residual value under the proposed standard versus the residual value that you need to estimate today when you're depreciating your property?
So today what we're doing is I have a 25-year asset. I know what I bought the plane for. The industry standard is generally around 15% at the end of the 25 years. We do, when a plane plane type goes out of production, we do a bottoms-up buildup of what we think the salvage value at the end is. The issue here with the residual, it's not coming up with the residual at the end of life. It's the end of the lease. And there's no fair values to use out there. You know, I'll be happy to share with you kind of the appraisers how much they would vary in their view. And what my discounted cash flow valuation of the residual is, I'm willing to bet, is going to be significantly different than what of my competitors thinks. And so if you're a user of the financial statements, how they don't find that helpful.
So if I just make sure I understand that you're saying today you're just coming up with a salvage
value at the end of 25 years, which is easier than the 3-year residual or the 5-year residual and doing that multiple times throughout life?
That's correct.
George Loros?
Yeah, for the auto industry, excuse me, we are able to get good data on market values because we have such a high volume of vehicles flowing through. We have auctions that are happening daily, weekly. We're able to get very precise estimates. Where the nuance comes in is not the measurement of the value, it's the sheer volume of what's running through. And we look at it under the standard that we would have type A leases for our vehicles. And the idea of splitting the finance component from this residual asset, I mean, it's a mathematical exercise, but when you lump in all the leases we have, you're going to end up with these two balances that are just going to continue to roll as new leases come on and off and things kind of happen, that I don't know if that's going to be real beneficial to the user of the financial statements. To me, what's beneficial to the user of the financial statements is what is the aggregate balance and what is happening at the end of the lease term. And we don't manage our lease portfolio to have gains or losses at the end. We're trying to figure out how many leases we're going to get back and what we should be, quote unquote, depreciating those assets to at the end. So it's basically a true-up of depreciation. We have over 800,000 leases, about $20 billion in our portfolio. It's a very active portfolio. And under the current proposal, it would create a lot of work to do this, but we don't see where the benefit would be to the user. So that's primarily our concern with that. we use a lease servicing system to service our leases, much like a loan system. We are bound by specific contractual laws in certain states about the form of our lease and what we can and cannot do. So in terms of the economics that this will have on our business, it's really not going to impact our customers. It's not going to impact the way we view the risk, but it will have a profound impact on the amount of work we would have to do to drive the financial statement disclosure. And like I said, given the size of our portfolio, we don't know breaking these two components apart what the benefit would be to the user of the financial statements.
Rick Peterson?
Well, on the lessor side, we have a fairly simplistic view that on the lessee, you have a contract to account for. On the lessor side, you have an underlying asset and you have a contract. In our view, when you look at those contracts, either you have substantially sold the underlying or you have not. We can't get wrap our minds around partial sale accounting from the lessor perspective. And if you look at what the board has done in some other projects, like sale of financial assets, the board was very explicit in saying you have a 25-year bond, have level debt set service payments over 25 years. If you, no matter how well you structure it legally, you cannot have a good sale for accounting purposes of the first 5 years of that 25 years of cash flow. It is not a sale. If I can't do that with a financial asset, I don't know how I can do it with a plane. So in my mind, the 5-year lease or the 25-year asset, I have a failed sale. We typically don't record receivables for failed sales. So at the end of the day, it works me around to getting pretty close on the lessor side to what we do today. And because when I look at the lessee side, I'm looking at, I still have a valuable contractual right. I have a right to use a plane for 5 years. So in my mind, I can still have an asset and a liability on the lessee side, and on the lessor side say, I have a failed sale. I need to have appropriate disclosures on what's going on, length of the lease of the term of the lease, that sort of thing. But I don't see the symmetry problem that others see in that particular approach. Last thing I will say about lessor accounting is, in our mind, the most important thing about lessor accounting is to try and be as consistent as you can with your revenue recognition project. It is just inevitable, if there are differences, that after these two standards are out, there will be an industry created to work off the differences between the two on what accounting answer do you want and whether we structured as an outright sale or we structured as a lease. So there's some things in this document I think we could that could be helped a little bit on that account, but that's kind of my overarching thing on the lessor side is consistency with the revenue recognition project.
Tom Linsmeyer, then Kimber, then Darrell.
Rick, I think you raise a very interesting point. In our journey in developing exposure drafts in this area, we've tended to concentrate on lessee accounting for weeks and months. And when we're done with it, very quickly presume that there ought to be symmetry between lessee accounting and lessor accounting. And you're saying no, that there ought to be symmetry with the revenue recognition project. And one area where I think that you've all raised that would suggest lessor accounting is different than lessee is the lessor's got the residual risk, and the lessee does not. And so the total return on that contract is going to be dependent on what happens with that residual, right? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's far more important in the airline industry than it is in the car industry, but it's still very important, and so the economics might not be identically the same. It would be very useful when you comment as to whether you think that we've been wise about our choices in symmetry or really whether we ought to be thinking of these as different sorts of economic business models and therefore potentially not so tied to symmetry.
I thought of what else heard Rick say was the lessor owns the underlying physical asset. They still own the plane. They still own the real estate. And if you're going to recognize that as a sale, go through our revenue recognition model.
Well, and if you go through the revenue recognition model, there's several reasons why you'd recognize revenue over time. Not just that you're getting it back, but you could view the residual as variable consideration. You could view the underlying as being the whole asset, and therefore you don't transfer the whole thing like a financial asset. There's many reasons in the revenue recognition model you come back to recognizing revenue over time.
Kimber?
I think the concern over consistency with the revenue recognition model is one that we certainly share. The way that you think about that, though, in my view, goes back to what you believe the relevant item to account for is. I was thinking about how to maybe try to illustrate this as I was pouring my glass of water, and I was thinking, well, what if I thought about my glass of water as the asset, the underlying physical asset? When I enter into a transaction with a lessee, I'm giving them, this much water off the top. That's the economic resources that I'm giving to them. What's left for the lessor is, what's left in that glass. The problem is that I don't actually pour it out of the glass. I give it to them, and they take it out as it becomes available. And it isn't clear, again, to me why, when you say that for the lessee, if the economic value of that asset is comprised of these resources that are in it, to say that those resources still exist in their totality on the balance sheet of a lessor when they've actually delivered, performed at lease commencement, which is the notion behind the right of use, is hard to explain. At the same time, I appreciate that financial statement users kind of like that picture. So that drives me back to the importance in our minds of the boards thinking about these two questions together, both the lessee accounting and the lessor accounting. And to us, it ought to be the case that in a high-quality financial reporting model, you're able to explain the transaction for the two parties to the transaction in the same way. Now, that may not mean identical accounting. On the financial asset issue that Rick raised, I'll just point out that when the transferor doesn't get a sale, the buyer doesn't report the beneficial interest, they report a loan. So there is actually symmetry in that situation. I think on the lease accounting side, our concern continues to be that without thinking about both parties to the transaction, you lose something. If there's a financing for the lessee, there's got to be a financing for the lessor. You can't have a borrower without also having a lender, in our view. So it's just important to think about both of these at the same time. And maybe you don't change lessor accounting, but that ought to be important in thinking about lessee accounting as well.
Okay, Larry Smith and then Heidi Roth.
So with your water example, does that mean to imply that, what I took from that was effectively you did sell that that portion of the water, and therefore you ought to, in your mind, de-recognize that portion and effectively get gain or loss on day of sale. And I'm putting words in your mouth. Do you think that would be consistent with the RevRec model?
I think if you're accounting for the right of use, you would de-recognize that layer at the top, and it would be consistent with the revenue recognition model. Because if you believe it's been delivered at commencement, the lessee has control over it, and that's all that underlying asset comprises, is that bundle of economic rights, then it's gone. The lessor no longer has it.
So at the end of the day, you and Rick totally disagree with how to do it, but yet you both think it's consistent with the RevRec model because you're both have different units of account, I think.
I never want to say I disagree with Rick because that's a dangerous thing to do. What I would say is that I think we both agree that it depends on what you're accounting for. And I think Rick, not to speak for you, but I think you're saying that you believe that the underlying asset is the important thing to account for the lessor.
Yeah, I think if I could stay in the analogy, I think Rick's saying that the glass has value even if you pour all the water out.
I think Rick's saying the glass goes there and the glass comes back, so there's never any transfer of control.
Right.
And it's not clear to me the revenue recognition model, even if we accept Kimber's analogy, would end up recognizing revenue up front. If you view the fact that the water that you're going to get, what you're going to get back is not the fixed amount of water that was left, but something of different value, you could consider that variable consideration and have to decide whether you recognize revenue under the first part.
But that would suggest that you don't agree that the type A lease accounting is consistent with lessor with revenue either. Because in type A lease accounting, you can definitely get the asset back.
Okay. Heidi Roth.
Thank you. We would echo and agree with a lot of what's been said already by both Ed and Elias on the lessor accounting model. The one thing that I would add is, as a lessor of multi-tenant office buildings, some of which have 30 to 35 tenants, it would be very difficult for us to take certain of those floors or those suites off balance sheet. And I think NAREIT, in their previous comment letter, has demonstrated that that's just an unworkable model for real estate.
Anyone else on lessor accounting? Okay. Go ahead, Ed Conjoyan.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know that right now, as far as lessor accounting, real estate is being treated differently from other types of assets. But to the extent they become treated the same as this exposure draft evolves, I guess to echo on Heidi's comments, from our perspective, I guess if we were fully leased, we would de-recognize all of our 70 million square feet of assets. So we wouldn't have any real estate assets on our books. And instead of receiving rent every month, we would get interest. And so from being an owner of real estate, I guess we're a bank. And I would have a tough time going back to the owner of our company telling him that, good news, you're in a new industry, you're a banker. That's just not, anybody in the real estate industry, that's just not what we're doing. So I know that doesn't apply, but to the extent we evolve there, I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Elias?
And that comment, I think, is valid also for lessors of any long-lived asset, whether it's the real estate or aircraft or like shipping. There's a lot of similarities in the kinds of assets we have. So this partial sale treatment does distort our balance sheet and does distort our income statement. And I think we need to be mindful about, who the users of our financials and why they need that information. And if we're going to end up distorting this, have we improved financial reporting from that perspective?
Pat Billing.
Yes, I think, we've talked about a lot of different ways to define the types of leases, but at the end of the day, there are multiple types of leases, and you do have to look at the distinguishing piece of them. It can't just be one model for it. whether it be capital or operating, this type A or type B, it's really in how all we define that, be it the control that's there, whether executory contracts, you can come up with how that's looked at today. I completely agree with Elias. It's how do the users use the information? The way that we're defining it today and the complexities that we're adding into through the guidance and then adding disclosure on top of that seems to imply that the way that we're moving to is not going to get the users to where they want to be, so we need to give them additional information so they can adjust for it. So we seem to be heading in a very vicious path that will take a lot of cost and a lot of time to no avail. So I think we really need to look at what the issues are today, which I'm unfortunately not able to define because I haven't heard from people to say what it is that they can't, from a user perspective, get out of the way that we're doing it today with capital leases and operating leases. And back to just a two-second thing on the glass, too. At the end of the day, that water usage that's in there is just the rent on a real estate property, the occupancy of that space. I can fill that with wine later, and it has more value. I put in a tenant that's going to pay me higher rents tomorrow than they do today, and the value of my asset just went up.
George?
Yeah, we were talking about on the real estate side, you view yourself as a finance company. Well, we do view ourselves as a finance company, and we're here to help our parents sell vehicles. We use an independent dealer network to facilitate those transactions, and whether the customer buys that vehicle and we finance the contract or they lease that vehicle and we buy that lease contract, we view it as a financing activity. But that goes back to the uniqueness of the asset. Just because our business model, we view ourselves as a finance, real estate, aircraft, you might not get to the same conclusion on that.
Okay, Darrell Buck.
Now, is it the uniqueness of the asset or is it the business model? Because I mean, could you not have a business model that used exactly the same asset as you do, where you consider it to be financing, but perhaps because it was a longer-term lease, similar to some of these other longer-term leases for airlines or real estate, to where potentially that lessor may view it differently and not view it as a financing?
Yeah, and I would say it would probably be general to the auto industry, because we're not just – we're a captive finance company, but there are other competitors out there, Ally, Chase, that offer the same suite of products we do. And so if they're offering a loan versus a lease option as well, you know, they're a bank. And so banks by nature are in the financing business. So partly, yes, it's dependent on the asset, but I think broader thing, that's the way the industry operates.
Any other comments on the lessor model? Go ahead, Jeremy.
I guess it gets back to the classification of the leases themselves, do we need to be so focused on the property type, whether it's real estate or equipment, or should we be focused more on the financing aspect of it and the consumption of that asset over a length of time? Are we using this asset over a long period, or are we using the asset over a short period? And that's how we should differentiate the lease account.
Again, any other comments on the lessor model before we move on to our next topic? Okay, if not, Lisa will tee up our next topic, which is on measurement.
Great, thank you. If everyone turns to page 5 in their agenda, you'll see we'll be talking about questions 5 through 8. These are going to cover 3 main topics. It's going to include the lease term, variable lease payments, and then reassessment of both of those. Based on the feedback of the 2010 ED, the boards have tried to simplify some of the requirements for lease term and variable lease payments. For your lease term in this ED, you will include renewals only if there is a significant economic incentive. And for variable lease payments, you're going to include those in your measurement if they're linked to an index or a rate. It would be helpful if each of you comment on whether or not you agree or disagree with these changes. If you disagree, we'd like to know why, and if you have any potential recommendations. With that, I'll turn it over.
Okay. Wants to start the discussion on measurement. think we, a couple folks alluded to it earlier on, if they want to elaborate on those views now. Variable lease payments, everyone comfortable with proposal?
Jeremy, from a user perspective, what do you think about variable lease payments?
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. I think that the variable payments can be projected and adjusted over time on an annual basis. I think they should be factored into the calculations. Clearly, when entering into a lease, if a lease is providing for a percentage rent clause, that's clearly factored into the economics of the lease from a landlord perspective. And I think we should be factoring that into the accounting measurements as well.
Pat Bailey.
You've asked for what are some ways that you can simplify things, and that's one of the things that we look at, and we see the constant reassessment with systems that don't exist today. That constant reassessment really adds a lot of cost and complexity to implementing this exposure draft. One of the things that we suggested in our letter was to say that if you can make an assumption up front of what those CPI increases or whatever the measurement is, that would be increasing those rents over time. But instead of reassessing it over time and making certain assumptions going forward, assume it at the front of the lease, and then any differentials could just pass through as additional rent or expense items through the financial statements as period expenses and revenues.
Elias?
So one of the concerns, you know, we understand the concept behind what's been proposed around variable lease payments, but from an operational perspective, and also when we deal with the Type A model and on aircraft leasing, you know, one of the things we collect sometimes from our lessees are variable cash flows based on the usage of the plane. And so when we think about the residual value at the end of the current lease, we would need to, and let's take a brand new plane, a 25-year plane, first lease is 10 years. In addition to projecting what, if any, variable payments we may collect over the first 10 years, we have to project what's going to happen over the next 15 years when we don't know which airline it's going to go to or which jurisdiction. And as this becomes clearer, you know, our initial forecast could be off and most likely is going to be wrong. So now we're creating accounting volatility in our earnings just because we've had to guess what was going to happen for the next 15 years. And that, so operationally to do that, our systems today don't do that. So we're going to have to design and build the systems to do it. But then we're creating earnings volatility just because we're having to update our forecast for what's going to happen, you know, 20, 25 years out. And I'm not sure how that's beneficial to the users of the financial statement. I'm not sure what that's telling.
Ed?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that, you know, I agree that the variable lease payments are very difficult to project, and it seems that in coming up with this new construct, we've encountered things like, well, how do you handle variable lease payments? How do you handle options? And when they seem too difficult, well, let's put variable lease payments to the side. So I find it curious that variable lease payments get a pass under this structure. I have a feeling that a lot of leases will be structured with variable lease payments. If we're worried about structuring around rules, I have a feeling that's going to be the result. Fact of the matter is, if I may begin to sound like a broken record, I think the existing disclosure, footnote disclosure, is frankly the best mousetrap, and they're trying to come up with a new one. It seems we've come up with the Rube Goldberg device where we go down this lever, well, various variables don't work, let's flip it over there and shut that off. And in any case, the point being, I think with the existing disclosures, you can improve them by showing historical variable lease payments so that you give some indication of what companies have actually incurred right there in the footnote. Not just the fixed rent they owe, but some historical trend. Granted, history doesn't necessarily show future, but at least to give some future, some information to the users of the financial statements. I think otherwise you end up with what Elias was suggesting. Every company is making guesses on their own. You're not getting clarity, consistency. I think what you would end up with is garbled information that is less useful to users of financial statements rather than more useful.
Okay. Daryl and then Tom.
Sort of on that point, and given what Elias said, I kind of wanted to follow up back with Jeremy and see if, you know, given the cost and complexity that Elias was referring to and the potential for a lot of variability in what gets reported, do you think that users would find, you know, accounting for variable lease payments to be useful given those factors?
Yeah, I think they would. I think that the certainly recognizing that it would be difficult to estimate these payments, but I don't think it would be any more difficult than when we have to look at contingent consideration, look at in the financial instrument model, the expected loss model that is being created. You know, there are. You would have to give consideration to what has happened in the past and project out. And I think that's something that we're asked to do in other areas. I don't understand why, when it's so integral to the lease, that we just ignore it.
Daryl,
I wanted to follow up with Elias. Do you think your customers would come to you and ask for lease payments to be based on variability, such as on usage, so that they will not have as big of a liability to recognize? And is that something that you would consider as a lessor?
So our business model today is our leases are generally fixed rate leases, and over and above that there will be supplemental rent for usage. We're not sure yet how our customers would react. About 95% of our business is done outside the U.S., mostly in Asia and in Europe. So that might be a possibility. The other possibility is we've started hearing, well, can we restructure them as 12-month leases and keep rolling them to get around it? And from our perspective, that's too much risk from a business to take on. Because an aircraft, while it's a mobile asset you could move, you know, if you're moving it from an Air France to Cathay, their internal configuration would be different. So we do need time to reconfigure planes, so you can't take on that much risk.
So can I push back a little bit on, you know, one of the assertions being made is that people will try to structure their leases such that it's all variable or maximize the degree to which they're variable from a lessee perspective. And I guess the question is, how practical is that in terms of, you know, your ability to obtain financing for your business? I mean, would the people that are loaning money to you actually allow you to structure your deals that way, or would the cost of financing become prohibitive so that from a practical standpoint you would not be able to do that?
So this is kind of in the hypothetical, because we haven't been approached to structured leases that way. I think it would become an issue, because the way we approach the capital markets and our investors is our leases are generally fixed rate cash flows. So most of our capital structure is fixed rate today. So if we're going to go back to them and say we're redoing our leases, they're variable, they're going to pay us a higher rate per hour flown or cycle flown than what we've done before, I think that could become an issue with our lenders and investors. But at the same time, we're not proposing to move that way.
And so in addition to your lenders, presumably if it's shifting more cost to you or more risk to you, it would impact rates. So if you wanted to move to 1 year, in addition to the transition cost, I guess have an impact on how you price transactions?
Definitely. We're taking more risk because we're going to be incurring more transition costs if they don't extend at the end of the year.
So it wouldn't just be done without economics?
That's correct.
Ed Conjoyan wants to weigh in.
Unless maybe the transition cost was built into your as a termination fee in your variable rent. But, you know, we're getting hypothetical here. But the fact of the matter is there shopping center leases, to a great extent, are variable leases today. And shopping centers are built and financed and constructed all the time. So.
Tom Linsmeyer, then Rick Peterson.
Jeremy, in some respects, I'm going to address this to you because I'll tell you what I'm struggling with in terms of variable lease payments. To me, when there's a lease contract and you get a right to use and it's specified you can use it however you want, but if you use it for more or if there's sales or whatever, you pay more, it seems to me that there is an obligation in that contract for the right to use. And conceptually, it could be considered part of the lease liability. However, there's issues of faithful representation. And I have a great deal of concern about the ability of people to predict sales 15, 20, 25 years from now, and the volatility that might arise in any estimate is if it's flowed through the current period or built into the asset and liability and dealt with over time. It would seem to me that a faithful representation of that obligation would be highly variable, and I don't know how useful the tail would be in any immediate use for understanding the economics of the contract. But I'd like a reaction, because I think you're saying you'd like to see it go all the way through time. So the question I want to ask you is, are you most interested in understanding what variable lease payments might be in the near term, or it be based on near-term projections of what, say, sales are going to be in the shopping center, et cetera, rather than the next 2 years and the next 20 after that? Would it be sufficient to be given some insight into what the history of the variable payments were, and if there are insights into the future variable payments, would that be enough? Because I have a very hard time seeing this remeasurement flowing through all the time, on the tail end stuff being all that eventually useful. In our impairment project, you mentioned impairment, we've, even with a lifetime estimate, said you only have to look out for reasonable and supportable forecast period to be able to update a lifetime estimate, because we don't think you can go beyond that. So I'd just like to get some insight from you, if you don't mind.
Well, I think I would go back to Ed's comment, and, you know, shopping centers are built all the time. They're financed all the time, and the leases are percentage rent leases. They're variable payments. So they are financeable. I don't think anyone is preparing projections for those that extend out 25 years. They're probably extended out for maybe 10 years at most, because many of the debt instruments coincide with a 10-year and a refinancing thereafter. I think things can be structured accordingly, but to ignore such an integral element to a lease, I think, is short-sighted.
So you want it for the full life, and the near-term projections are not sufficient for you?
I think it might differ depending upon how that information is used. If you're getting back into your type A or type B model, I think there might be a difference in what you would look for.
I just want to understand if that's a perspective from a user of financial statements, or if that's a perspective as a member of the valuation profession, and whether that differs.
Maybe both. I mean, I'm speaking from my own personal opinions, and you know, I certainly have consulted with those within our firm and spoken to clients in the industry. I mean, I think a lot of these issues are certainly intertwined. I mean, it gets back to my comment before. You know, is it appropriate to differentiate your leases based upon, you know, the type of asset as opposed to how that economically is used over a period of time?
Rick?
Well, from my perspective, the variable lease issue comes down to a cost-benefit analysis. I think there are issues as to how much benefit you get for some of the things that Tom talked about. Conceptually, they are part of the measurement of the liability. It's a cost-benefit. I'm not sure how much benefit you get because you are making projections for such a long period of time about with so many different unknowns. And then secondly, the cost side and remeasuring every accounting period. So in my mind, I came down thinking that the board's basic approach on variable payments made sense, but it wasn't because I thought, well, gee, that's the best conceptual answer in the whole world. I just thought at the end of the day, taking into consideration cost benefit, that was a reasonable place to be.
And that includes, when you say the board's conclusions were reasonable, that includes the conclusions about variability tied to indices?
Including in the calculation the variable payments that are based on an indice, yes. I think those should be part of the measurement. My only concern about that is the remeasurement when it comes to the CPI or whatever it is. And again, are we creating more work? Are we getting incrementally that much more benefit if we recalculate based on a change in CPI every period, or are we better off just doing what we do today and flow through the differential in the CPI each period as it occurs? You know, we came down ultimately in our letter thinking just do what we do today with those changes in CPI, that it just wasn't worth the additional effort. But certainly we think that what the index is at the inception of the lease, I mean, yes, that should be part of the calculation of the lease liability.
Okay, and I think that's what Pat had suggested earlier, right? Kimber, I don't know if you wanted to say something there.
Yeah, if I can just add something quick. We totally agree with everything Rick just said on the variable lease payments. The reassessment aspect of it is something we spent quite a bit of time looking at and doing some modeling. And for those payments that are based on an index or rate, it looks to us like in the P&L you're going to get virtually the same result whether you reassess or not. There might be some small balance sheet, you know, gross up, gross down that occurs as a result of the reassessment, but it made us wonder about the benefits of doing that versus just doing what we typically would do for variable rate debt, for example.
Okay. Darrell?
Yeah, I'd like some feedback on another aspect of measurement, and that's with the renewal options. And the concept of the significant economic incentive to renew. How workable do you all think that is? How understandable, et cetera?
Kimber, you can start off.
The renewal options, we support the idea of including renewal periods in the lease term based on a threshold. The thing that we struggled with, frankly, was changing the terminology. And, you know, we've listened to the discussions of the boards and have come away with the impression that the boards are really not, we think, trying to change the threshold versus what we have in GAAP today, significantly anyway. And so we wonder about the change in terminology. We also struggled a little bit with the comments around market-based factors and how you think about market-based factors or actually don't think about market-based factors when it comes to reassessments. And we really struggle with that because it seems like market-based factors are such an inherent element of your decisions around whether to renew or not to renew a lease. I mean, they're certainly a part of the decision, maybe not the only part of the decision.
Jim Kroper.
I'm trying to really get an answer to the question, you know, if we're not trying to change current GAAP and whether current GAAP and IFRS are converged, because one of the things we're trying to accomplish is convergence and they have different terms. And I've heard different opinions on whether reasonably assured is the same as reasonably certain in practice. So just at a real practical level, if we were to choose one of those two terms, would it matter? I don't know if your experience, U.S. GAAP or IFRS, is they're different?
I've had experience with both, and as far as I'm able to tell, they're basically applied in the same way, I mean, for all intents and purposes.
So it kind of wouldn't matter, we could just pick one?
Personally, I think you could pick one.
Pat, go ahead.
With regard to term with real estate contracts, leases are in many cases longer term leases, and to have to reassess it kind of goes back to the variable rate piece and the fact that the cost benefit, to Rick's point earlier, is not necessarily there, and what may seem from a market perspective to be positive and it would be something that you would want to exercise 5 years from now, today in a year from now may not be a market-based rent amount that you would want to exercise at that point in time. So to do that on an ongoing basis seemed like it was not time well spent as we looked at this, and really kind of thought that you should assess the time period that you're looking for, and then if you exercise that option, then you just reestablish at that point in time.
Okay. Anyone else in the area of measurement? Go ahead, Mary Ann.
So the only thing I want to talk about a little bit is related party. So within our group, we sometimes may have a legal entity, a standalone, that leases assets and then turns around and leases those assets to other related parties within the control group. So we may be in a situation where the same piece of equipment is being accounted for from both a lessee and a lessor perspective. And we understand where the boards are going with this, but we're wondering if there should be more of a practical expedient for related party leases, such that an election can be made that related party leases do not have to apply the proposed standard, just because the amount of work that may be resulting from having both sides of the transactions, the resources required, the eliminations, and most related party leases are not arm's length transactions as they stand.
Darrell, I think you have a question on that.
Yeah, Mary Ann, could you help us understand a little bit more what the current accounting gives you, how that benefits you versus what's been proposed with related party, which, you know, the proposal is just account for it based on the agreement between the parties, regardless of the substance. I guess our assumption was within related party groups that would be easier and more cost beneficial, and then your related party disclosures would take care of communicating to third parties that these are special arrangements. So help us understand why it would be beneficial for you to continue to apply the substance over form treatment that we have today.
Well, I think that with the proposal as it stands, you know, obviously there's a lot more to it. It's the measurement up on the balance sheet. There's a lot more calculations that go behind it than under today's accounting rules. And we just think it would be a lot more egregious to apply the proposed standard to such leases than under today's accounting.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is an exemption from the leases proposal period for related party leases?
Yes, you would just maybe perhaps account for it as a straight operating now.
Okay. Anyone else on the area of measurement before we take our break? Okay, go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but on the issue of cost benefit that was raised, I guess I like the fact that that the cost of trying to constantly reassess the or determine what these percentage rents are going to be meant that they were excluded. But we would take that even further and suggest that the overall cost of implementing this new rule, be it internal costs by the companies that have to implement it, the lessees and the lessors, be it the cost to the economy in general, which there's been a couple studies out there that have looked at that, or be it the for instance, we haven't talked yet about loan covenants and the cost that companies will face by having to go back to their banks and deal with the breach of those, and then you weigh that against the benefits and again this the information that would be in the financial statements under this new rule. Would not be the rent that's in the lease. It would be contrived information that each company makes up on their own. And I find it interesting that for years we've been saying, we were at the Chicago Roundtable, and we've been saying, you know, who are the users? Who are the investors that are asking for this? And we've been told, well, they're out there, and they're demanding this. And your own investor advisory committee has recently come out and said that, in fact, they don't see the utility of contrived information. They think that, in fact, the representation of pure information that's being disclosed now under GAAP is something that's more beneficial. So in the cost benefit, we just see a lot more cost for very little benefit.
And we'll have the opportunity for closing, general type comments, towards the end of our, at the very end of our 3 hours together, but points noted. We'll now take a 15-minute break, so we'll resume at 5 minutes to 11.